The first bit of my role is to introduce our presenters today. I won't go off the script. First of all, I've got Gary Jeffries here, who has over 10 years' experience of doing long-tail claims management in a number of organisations. Before he arrived at WorkCover New South Wales, he was up at the TIO with a responsibility for claims management of the motor vehicle portfolio. More recently at New South Wales WorkCover, he's been the Director of Claims with an absolute responsibility for the implementation of the 2012 reforms. And so he's got a lot of insight, which I'm looking forward to his contribution today. Next to Gary are Roland Fenn and Harry Haggath, who are two of the young stars in the PwC Sydney office. Over the last few years, they've done a lot of work in the New South Wales workers' compensation arena for various clients around the valuation, the reform, costings, premium rating and the like. So I think they do a good match with Gary in terms of what their insights as actuaries into the cost implications and the trends that we've been seeing both before and after the reforms. So I'm looking forward to this presentation. Over to you.
So Harry and myself being actuaries working in and around the New South Wales Workers' Comp Scheme, and for Gary being part of WorkCover, I think we've had a pretty unique and interesting chance to look at exactly what happens to a scheme that goes under legislative reform. Amid widespread media coverage and people picketing outside Government House and lawyers and trade unions up in arms about these reforms, these were the biggest set of reforms to hit the scheme in more than a decade. And hopefully over the course of our presentation, we're going to take you on a bit of a journey through these reforms. A bit of a journey that, had a lot of uncertainty at the beginning about what the reforms were going to look like and what kind of cost impact that we're going to have. A journey that at some times required you to just drop everything and come pull together information to help with the parliamentary inquiry. And a journey that really 12 months, a little more than 12 months down the track, has provided some pretty interesting results and unexpected results. So our journey today will hopefully cover the following things. We're going to look through some of the drivers of the reforms and exactly why the government felt like legislative reform was necessary. We'll then give a quick snapshot about the reform package itself before moving on to some of the emerging experience that we're seeing a bit over 12 months down the track. Gary will then provide us with some of the insight from his perspective at WorkCover and dealing with the implementation of the reforms and the day-to-day at the coalface kind of stuff. And we'll finish up by just looking at some of the risks and opportunities that still exist for the scheme moving forward. The focus of our paper and the focus of our presentation is around the WorkCover scheme itself, and we haven't actually looked at the impact on self and specialised insurers at this stage. Before we go along, just wanted to draw your attention to this graph. And this was originally taken from a presentation given at the 2002 Accident Compensation Seminar and shows, and from the WorkCover Victoria half yearly report, and shows the number of common law applications immediately after they introduced impairment threshold. And as you can see there, for the first four quarters after the introduction, the experience is actually, well, there was no experience really. Nothing much really changed. But then for the 4 years after that, you can see this massive increase in the number of applications lodged in the scheme. Now, why do I want to show you this graph? Well, it kind of symbolises the amount of uncertainty that goes through a scheme once it goes through legislative reforms. No one could have guessed at how quickly these would have risen when they were first costing these. And it's the situation that New South Wales is in at the moment. We're 12 months in and there's still a lot of uncertainty. And there's a lot of work to be done, but hopefully, if it's managed correctly, our journey will be different to that. So a question about reforms and why reforms are necessary. I mean, reforms don't happen often, and they're very major things. So why did the government feel that these legislative reforms are necessary? The drivers are really twofold. Firstly, there was a financial deterioration in the financial condition of the scheme. But underlying that were also some more deep-rooted issues, cultural issues that were emerging that the government felt was necessary to try and address. In terms of the financial situation, a large deficit had occurred at December 2011, and that was coming from a combination of deteriorating claims experience, resulting in poor return to work rates and the emergence of more of a lump sum culture, but also post-GFC investment returns being poorer than expected, and the implications of lower yield curves contributed to this as well. And it meant that the scheme went from about a $2.3 billion deficit at June 2011 to almost $4.1 billion at December. Now, this obviously then puts pressure on premium rates as well. And one of the objectives of WorkCover is to provide or to try and facilitate a competitive New South Wales economy through providing safe and healthy workplaces. And at the time, it was already claimed that premium rates in New South Wales were between 20 to 60% higher than equivalent jurisdictions. And without further action, estimated increases of about 28% were needed to address the deficit situation. And so obviously this is not sustainable.
So those financial issues were quite important, but they might not have been enough on their own to make these legislative changes happen. The government also recognised a poor claim culture, with increases in litigation and poor recovery outcomes for claimants. So the government wanted to move towards the philosophy of recover at work, where work itself is used to create purpose and engagement, improve well-being and speed recovery, meaning better welfare outcomes for claimants and better financial outcomes for the scheme. The government also saw an opportunity to increase investment. So we're all quite familiar with the kind of long-tailed nature of the scheme, but to put that into, to make that a little more real for us, imagine a 15-year-old apprentice seriously injured in a construction accident today. They could be on weekly payments until 2065. We'll probably all be retired before the last of the current work cover claimants stop getting benefits. But early interventions can be the most productive, before a claimant becomes systematised, de-skilled and disengaged. So the government wanted to support scheme agents to make investments in claimant recovery that would pay dividends in the long run. The government also wanted to provide better support for seriously injured workers. Long-term weeklies were barely keeping people above the poverty line before the reforms. So with these financial pressures and deeper issues, there was an enormous political will to act for change. And when we were costing those reforms, we definitely felt that pace of change. So, this political will paid big dividends in terms of the scale of change. New incentives were introduced for recover at work with step-downs and cut-offs, and work capacity assessments were used to shift the focus from incapacity to capacity. In order to protect seriously injured workers, they were mostly exempted from the limits on lump sum, from new limits on lump sum benefits, medical durations and weekly durations. By aligning weeklies with pre-injury earnings, those claimants who really could not return to work will have their living standards maintained above the poverty line. And in order to make this scheme a little bit less adversarial, a new decision review process was introduced, which uses administrative law and process review to protect fairness. And there are some other changes.
So given the uncertainty around these reforms, it's quite obvious that monitoring is very key to the ongoing success of the reforms. But this is not just about monitoring data, and actuaries love data, but it's not just about this. It's also about keeping an eye on what's coming through from the claims managers, from other stakeholders in the scheme, and getting their insights about what's happening in the coalface and how these reforms are being applied. But we're just going to take you through a little bit of what we see from the scheme 12 months on, just looking at some of the key indicators. And the first one of these is around the number of claims being reported to the scheme. And so you can see from the graph there that up until 30 June 2012, the number of claims that were being reported to the scheme was actually fairly stable, averaging about 20,700 claims per quarter. As a result of the reforms, we would have expected this number to decrease due to various exclusions, for example, for journey claims, and these would have historically represented about 8 or 9% of the scheme. Now, if we jump forward 12 months, you can see here that the drop has actually been quite substantial, going from 20,700 down to about 15,500 claims reported to the scheme per quarter. And this is far in excess of what we would have expected, and points to a potential behavioural change in the scheme. This next graph here looks at the number of claimants who are receiving weekly payments in each quarter. And leading up to the reforms, in the 12 months leading up to the reforms, you can see that the experience has actually deteriorated slightly. And it was averaging about 42,500 claimants receiving weekly benefits per quarter. Jump forward again, 12 months. I think the picture really speaks for itself, and that's a very significant drop again. So that's dropped down to about 34,500 claims receiving active weeklies per quarter. Now, what does this all mean? Right. Obviously, there's been a significant drop, but we have to try and explain that. And at the moment, there's really no concrete evidence. However, there is some anecdotal evidence that's led us to sort of come up with some hypotheses for why we're seeing what we're seeing. So firstly, it's believed that as a result of some of the introductions of these reforms, with the introduction of the five-year cap on benefits for weeklies, with the introduction of work capacity assessments, it's now no longer as appealing for claimants with lower severity injuries to try and get through the system. It's just too much hard work. There's another hypothesis that basically says that there are a subset of claims who went into the scheme purely to try and get lump sum benefits, the Section 66 statutory lump sums. And with the introduction of a permanent impairment threshold for these claimants, once again for the lower severity injuries, it was not worthwhile anymore. And in terms of the drop in the number of active weeklies that we're seeing in the data, anecdotal evidence suggests that actually some claimants who have been in the scheme for a while, been in the system for a while, have realised the gig is up, and before they're found to have work capacity, have decided to take other avenues to try and actually return to work. And what we're also seeing is that, we've looked at weeklies because this is the main driver of the liability in the scheme, but we're also seeing similar experience across medical payments as well. Moving on, this graph here shows the number of intimations for the statutory lump sum Section 66 benefit type. And in the lead up to the reforms, actually the experience doesn't look too bad, looks okay. But what was starting to emerge was a top-up culture where claimants were incrementally getting more and more permanent impairment benefits. With the introduction of the permanent impairment thresholds in the reforms, we would expect this the number of intimations to decrease. And 12 months later, they have, dropping from about 2,700 claims per quarter to about 850. But this payment type in particular is quite unique, quite uncertain, because just recently there was a case that had gone through the court system, some of you may be familiar with it, the Gudapel case, which overturned the legislation by removing some of the retrospectivity around the legislation that was originally introduced. I guess the key lesson from all of these graphs that we've just seen is, how do you interpret the data? As actuaries, we need to make sense of this and use this. And the key questions that come up are really, can we use this, and if so, how much? In a paper that was presented, as I mentioned before, at a previous accident comp seminar, the authors of the Spikes and Honeymoons paper looked at the impact of legislative reforms on a number of schemes, CTP, workers' comp schemes, and discovered that often there may be what's known as the honeymoon effect immediately following legislative reform. During this honeymoon, there's a period of really good experience, but inevitably this then turns and deteriorates as the honeymoon starts to wear off. Now, what we're seeing here could be a potential honeymoon, but 12 months on, it's really too early to say, and it's going to be a long time before it actually starts to all stabilise and the true impact of the reforms are known. And this has big implications for our work as actuaries and for other stakeholders in the scheme. All right, so I'll pass over to Gary now.
It's certainly been a very big 12 months in New South Wales from a reform point of view. I think 12 months ago when we looked at this and we were daunted with the task of transitioning 34,000 claims to a new system, those that have been involved in this process would agree with me, it was quite scary. The legislation and the reforms stated that we had to do a work capacity assessment on all of those claims to put them into the new system. And when we drafted the reforms, work capacity assessments were very successful in Victoria. In some other states, not so successful. So we wanted to have a very slow and steady approach to build capacity in New South Wales, which has had a very good effect. We've had very little media around this, and we're due to complete transition at the end of November. So it has been very successful. But some of the key fundamentals that we were looking at promoting was consistency and sound decision making. And we didn't want work capacity assessments to become a tool for fixing the tail. We wanted it to be a tool for transition and a long-term tool for our new book of claims. So that's worked quite well. We wanted to ensure that we promoted all opportunities for return to work and plan communication throughout the process. So we put very strict guidelines in place for the insurers around how to communicate with the workers, the employers, through this process to ensure that it was a very transparent process. Oops. So some of the key observations and learnings that we've had throughout this process was the return to work outcomes, especially in the tail. So prior to commencing transition, we had a tail project where we applied some very strong rehabilitation fundamentals to our existing tail claims, and that's flowed through and allowed us to actually apply better work capacity assessments to those long-term tail claims. The attitude of the agents has been critical to the success of transition, so there's been a greater willingness to share information and feedback across the system in New South Wales, including engagement of self and specialised insurers, which has worked really well for us. And WorkCover's increased interaction with agents has also been important. So we have a much more of an engaged model with our scheme agents compared to prior, and we're working much closer to collaborate with insurers. We still have challenges, a lot of challenges. Despite the very strong results in New South Wales, there's a lot that we need to do. So we have a lot of complex claims that we still need to manage into the new system, including we have about 2,000 sitting in the Workers' Compensation Commission, of which we have the challenge of ensuring that they're entitled to their judicial review, but also transitioning to the new system. And in a lot of those cases, they'll be on better entitlements than what they currently are, but we can't take that judicial process away from them. Ensuring that we maintain the quality of work capacity assessments and right across the system. So we have no delegations to control what happens across self and specialised insurers, but we do need to maintain that consistency of the application throughout the scheme. And ensuring that the new process is adopted as part of claims management. So we don't want work capacity to be a decision at 130 weeks. We want it to be something that the worker expects to happen throughout the life of a claim. So if you were to lodge a claim, we want people to know this is what's going to happen when you get to week 78, 80, 130 and so on. Opportunities, capacity building in the scheme. So New South Wales lacked investment for quite some time, and it was in a lot of deficit, as we know, and we were heading to a $4.5 billion deficit, and WorkCover itself hadn't invested in the system. So we've spent a lot of time scoping the new system, how we're going to move forward, the strategy moving forward, and then to work with the scheme agents to ensure that we actually invest in that moving forward. To Harry.
So just so on the road ahead there are still a lot of challenges, as Gary mentioned, and I guess the key risk and opportunity from our perspective is the way people behave. So it's about if claimants scheme agents, employers, medical professionals, actuaries and WorkCover can all work together towards recovery at work and towards implementing these work capacity assessments and a positive culture for claims, then the reforms can be a success. But if any of these stakeholder relationships fall apart, the downside for the scheme could be significant. With common law, one concern is that because of the honeymoon effects, so with people a bit worried about the reforms, they could choose to exit the scheme through common law. There's a potential for bracket creep. So the scheme protects the seriously injured, but who defines serious? The intention is for permanent impairment as assessed by doctors, but with these thresholds being so important, there could be pressure on doctors that results in higher permanent impairment scores. As Gary touched on, work capacity assessments are new to the scheme, and it's uncertain about how they'll ultimately play out. We've also seen alternative interpretations of the legislation. So, as Roland mentioned, with the Goodapel ruling was just not what we expected from the legislation in terms of lump sum benefits, and it's likely that there'll be more of these. So, I guess in conclusion, there seems to be a big cultural shift in the New South Wales WorkCover scheme, but reforms have had honeymoon periods in the past, and I guess it's too early to say whether this good experience will be sustained, and so there's still a lot of work to be done in the scheme.
So that's the end of the presentation, so it's time for any questions from the audience. I'd encourage you, please, if you have a question, to go to the mics that are positioned in the aisles and state your name and organisation before you ask your question, because it is being recorded. Does anyone want to go first?
Hi, it's Sharon from WorkCover Queensland. Gary, I wonder if you can make a comment, sort of talk there about, I guess, the number of claims decreasing, obviously the associated costs decreasing down as well, which is fantastic for you, and hopefully in the long term it's not just a honeymoon period, you can see it go on. But I was wondering if you could make a comment about the return to work outcomes, because I know in the most recent national survey your outcomes were really high, and I probably see it all related to that. I was wondering if you could make a comment on that.
Our return to work outcomes have improved by about 10%. Chris probably knows the absolute stats. But I think, Sharon, that's a result of prior to the reforms, we had some very strong projects that we'd implemented around return to work, and especially across our tail, which has had a flow on. So we invested very significantly across the way that we applied rehab, and also the way that we promoted recovery at work with our employer groups as well. So New South Wales has had a fundamental shift from focusing on return to work once you've recovered to it's healthy for you to be at work and to recover at work. So if that assists. But we have had a 10% improvement across all classes of claims.
Mike Gurney, Comcare. Just on the honeymoon period, how long do you think you need to be able to pick out the trends? I mean, would it be something like 18 months, that sort of period?
Have a go, Roland. If you want me to step in, I'll have a go.
Well, I guess, as you saw from the first graph, and Harry and I have affectionately called it the scary graph, the experience that they saw in that scheme didn't really settle down after 4 years and even after then continued to deteriorate. And so it's really hard to say how long this will take to settle down. I think these sets of reforms were very different to previous reforms seen in the scheme in the past, and so we don't really have a benchmark to say how long we would expect it to go. But it will be, certainly from the perspective of using the emerging experience in our modelling and in our work, it's going to be at least sort of 2 years before we have more stable experience, hopefully. But we just sort of have to see how people respond accordingly.
So certainly I'd suggest you'd probably be thinking about an 18-month sort of period, because if you looked at the quarterly type graphs, there was clearly seasonality in there. So you've got a lot of quarterly sort of movements. So if you replicate those movements over 18 months after the report, you've probably got enough evidence. But you know, we've seen similar patterns when we had the Sokola amendments in Comcare, and it did take a while to pull out. But it's just interesting.
I just maybe add a comment there. I think this is where kind of having conversations with, you know, with scheme agents, with WorkCover, with the people at the coalface is really important. Because if we can understand why their experience is different, then we will have a better indication of whether it's sustainable or whether it is a honeymoon or, you know, so it's yeah, it's that understanding what's going on behind the numbers that helps us to know when it's best to respond.
Lee Davidson, Insurance Australia Group. I was just wondering to what extent you would attribute the decline in claim lodgement to the removal of journey claims from the workers' comp scheme, and you obviously wouldn't have the data going into the CDP scheme, but the reduction in the workers' comp scheme.
Yeah, I think with the removal of journey claims, we've seen a significant drop in that, and I think historically, as mentioned, that contributed about 8 or 9% of the reported claims in the scheme. And since the reforms, pretty much about 90-ish percent of those journey claims that have been coded as journey claims has dropped off. And so there's still a significant amount that we can't attribute to journey claims, if that makes sense. So the overall 20 plus percent decrease that we've seen, only about 8 or 9% of that is from journey claims.
Did you expect that that experience to be fairly consistent coming forward, though you wouldn't expect to see an increase in journey claims coming back into the scheme, for example, would you?
We're not expecting journey claims to come back into the system at this point, but it's always a policy decision for government.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
David Hart. In discussions with a number of my self-insurers, an observation that I've seen in terms of the transition of claims from the old to the new system is that most of the time my clients are saying to me, oh, they're not going to meet the whole person impairment criteria, and therefore things like work capacity is not going to testing is not going to be an issue for them, because they're just going to transition them out of the system, if you like. Is that what being seen in WorkCover overall?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. You're talking about old claimants under the table of names?
Sorry, usually under ongoing weekly benefits.
If they've got a work capacity assessment and they're under 20%, they can transition them through. So I'm not sure. Are you referring to what criteria for whole person impairment?
Basically, if they've been on benefits for 2 years but won't meet the whole person impairment condition,
but
then they're... Then they're being transitioned out as to...
If they're under 20% and they've got capacity for employment, then potentially yes?
Yeah. Yes, they've got the capacity for employment.
Then that's part of the work capacity assessment to transition them off benefits, yeah.
Hello, Michael from ACT Government. You mentioned the bracket creep question, I suppose, and the pressure that's potentially putting on the whole person impairment guides. Can you tell us a bit about anything that New South Wales is doing to shore up the whole person impairment guides and to ensure that bracket creep doesn't?
Yeah, look, certainly. I mean, like, we're doing a review of the whole person impairment guidelines and the application of, so we've got the surgical associations doing that with us at the moment, and will get us out those through Parliament. A lot of it is good claims management, though, and the management of the scheme agents and the approach that we take to quality assurance of when we settle on a whole person impairment agreement.
Andrew Holmes from Taylor Fry. With the chart that you showed that showed the quite dramatic reduction in active weekly benefits, I wonder whether it might be possible to flesh that out a little more. To what degree is that front end, is there a significant contribution as well from dropping off of the older accident years? Is it predominantly partial incapacity weeklies or totals? And sorry if I can be greedy and add an extra bit. I'm also interested in, from a projection, future projection perspective, thoughts about how you determine how to treat that once-off drop, whether it means that the pool of remaining claimants is somehow different to what might have been there before, and the treatment of that in the projection assumptions that you set.
In terms of the drop in active claims, I think it's been pretty much across the board, so it's not just front end and not just the tail, it's sort of been across the board. So that's, hopefully that answers your first question. In terms of how we would treat it going forward in our projections, I guess when we're looking at it, we typically look at the last three development quarters when we're actually looking at how to project forward for the numbers. And so to the extent that the drop is sustained, then our models will sort of naturally calibrate towards that. But then we'd have to, and this is going back to Harry's point about understanding the cause of the drop, for our projections going forward, we may actually then, I think we just have to see what the expectation is in terms of if it is a once-off drop, we'd have to recalibrate the remaining continuing rates higher. And that would differ by whole person impairment band as well. So the experience and the behaviours of the more seriously injured claimants, you would expect that to be different to the ones that are less seriously injured, more seriously injured claimants, because they're not impacted by the work capacity assessments. You would expect to have higher continuums. And so when we model, we break it down into different whole person impairment bands, and then through conversations with insurers and work cover, come to our conclusion that way.
I might just add a little bit about the drop in active weekly numbers. It's not just been across all accident years that we've seen that drop. It's also been across all severity bands and also across those that were previously on total incapacity benefits or partial incapacity benefits. Well, I'd like you to join with me in thanking our presenters, because that's been a very interesting presentation.